Dear Dhamma friends, so we have come to the next part of the mindfulness for young adult session. So that is discussing a particular sutta or a short Dhamma sermon. And currently we are discussing what you call Khagga Visana Sutta. So literally means rhinoceros horn. So basically this sutta constantly highlights the value of solitude. So there are various ways that one can live, and typically people likes to live with many other people, with their loved ones and with their friends, and keeping a company with so many others. So that is the typical approach that we have. But throughout this particular sutta, Buddha highlights the value of being alone, to maintain a solitude life, a solitary life. So particularly this sutta is said to be consisting of various verses uttered by Paccheka Buddhas. You know, Buddha, the fully enlightened Buddha, or the Sammasambuddha, who has self-enlightened and capable of teaching others, is the supreme level, is the utmost level. And then there is another level called Paccheka Buddha, where he too can get self-enlightened, but he is not capable of teaching others. And there are other Savaka Buddha, where the followers of the Sammasambuddha, they sometimes can teach others and sometimes can't teach others, and they have some varying skills or capacities. Now these are the levels that typically mentioned in Dhamma, that how one can get fully enlightened. So here in these verses are mentioned that collected versions or collected verses of Paccheka Buddhas. Now we have discussed already two verses available in this sutta, and today we hope to go to the third verse, and it is going like this: Mitte suhajje anukampamano hapeti attang patibaddha chittu etang bhayang santave pekkhamano Eko chare kagga visana kappo. So this is the Pali verse. Mitte suhajje anukampamano. So sympathizing to the friends dear to one's heart. Hapeti attam patibaddha chitto. With mind attached, one forsakes the good. Etang bhayang santave pekkhamano. Seeing this peril in this intimacy, Eko chare khagga visana kappu. One should live alone like a rhinoceros horn. Now this is a kind of an interesting scenario. Now let's go to the story behind this verse. So there is one Paccheka Buddha, there is one king called Brahmadatta, available in this living in Varanasi. So this is a very common preamble coming in most of the stories pertaining to the old age. A king called Brahmadatta living in the city called Varanasi. So here, through this king, there was a son. So this son is the Paccheka Buddha to be. So once he become the king, so he understood that he has some inclination towards the spiritual life, inclination towards some supramundane kind of happiness, and so he likes to enjoy that. So he wants to be in jhana particularly. So he was attaining to jhana and he was able to be there. So rather than he spending a lot of time in mundane activities like governing the country and giving solutions to various problems and involving various administrative purposes, activities. So this king understood, now I can have a good rest, I can have a good seclusion while being in this this kind of a spiritual life, and he enjoyed that. And later he understood that his kingdom also has to be looked after. So what he did was he appointed four ministers to administer the country, administer the kingdom. So his ministers, by the way, are not very honest. So those four ministers actually taken bribe from certain people, and they sometimes give decisions in a sort of in a wrong manner, so that the people, the countrymen, started to quarrel, and they started to argue, and they started to complain that these ministers are not just, they are not righteous, and they are quite partial, they take bribes. So it seems like, I mean, today's terms and those days are very similar. And even today, people are very much like that. So they also take bribes, and they also give various wrong decisions. And sometimes they give verdicts, releasing the wrongdoers. And that is seems to be an old habit people are having. Anyway, so these four ministers are also doing like that. So they actually have taken bribe and not properly administering the country. Now, one time what happened was, there was a one very good friend of the king, and he too was subjected to some sort of a court case, we can say. And he actually was honest, and he was actually is the correct person. He's not the guilty person, or he's not the worthy, he's not the the wrongdoer. But anyway, these four ministers, actually he made him as the wrongdoer. They have given the verdict, freeing the other party and victimizing him. So anyway, so since this person is very close to the king, so he went and complained to the king that this incident has happened. He was quite honest, and he is correct, and he was hasn't done anything wrong, but these four ministers taking bribe from the other party has made him they have given a kind of a favoritism to the other party. So minister, this person has complained. Then the next day, king went to the courtroom, and there he found that many people are having such complaints. So many are complaining, not only this person, many are complaining that these ministers are not just, they are not righteous. They instead take bribes from various parties, and accordingly they give the verdict. So then it's like a quarrel going on in the courtroom. So king was, as mentioned before, is more leaning onto the spiritual side. So he is not interested about this kind of a situation. So he tried later, after this session is over, he went back to the palace, and he tried back to attain the jhana. But he couldn't, because he went through a lot of difficulties, a lot of arguments. He had to bear all these complaints. So many situation is there, many issues were there. So therefore, once he went back to the palace, he couldn't attain jhana. I think this is a common situation. Now most of you may be working, so you may like to spend some time on your own, not maybe jhana, but maybe some, even jhana, or whatever the seclusion, whatever the, say, pleasant abiding in your, say, meditation. But once you go to the office, so there are various problems sometimes. You have to attend to them. You have to listen to various complaints. You have to get on to various difficult situations. Sometimes people blame, sometimes people complain, sometimes people come to argue. So there are many such stressful situations. And once you come back home, probably you might not able to calm down yourself, because the arguments are so severe. So the situation was so tensed, and therefore your mind is heavily disturbed. So as a result of that, so once you come back, it's very difficult to settle yourself. So this is the same thing happened to this king. Now he has to take a decision, because in case he is maintaining that kind of a companionship, that kind of a situation, that kind of a friendship with these ministers and whoever the loved ones, then he is losing his sight. So then he's thinking whether this kingship or the kind of the ascetic duty. So he's weighing these two sides. He's thinking, am I going to continue this kingship, or am I have to leave this and completely let go of this and to have a complete ascetic life? So as he was able to arouse that kind of renunciative thoughts, he was able to calm down himself. Now he is sort of letting go of all the attachments. He is letting go of all the responsibilities. He is slowly removing from his mind all those attachments, all those responsibilities. So now again mind has become calm. Again he was able to let go of all those intimate relationships. So his mind has become further calm, relaxed. And as a result of that, he was able to again regain the attainments or regain the concentration. But now here he didn't stop there. Since he has went through a lot of troubles, he understood that it's a kind of a peril. It is kind of a danger again and again get into this situation. Even though he is the king, he don't have peace of mind. So he understood that situation. So rather than simply dwelling in that concentrated state, so he started to reflect about these realities. So slowly his mind understood the impermanent nature of this human situation. So the unsatisfactory nature, and it is some sort of a causal relationship. So further and further he is now investigating. His wise reflection is there. So he is doing such reflection. And he was able to even go further, letting go of all those conventional things, and again fully calms down the mind. And going deeper and deeper, he was able to understand the things as they truly are. And as a result, he was able to attain Paccheka Buddhahood. Now, once he has attained the Paccheka Buddhahood, so others actually didn't know it yet, because he is still in the king's clothing. Now they approach him and they use the term the king. But then this person, now the Paccheka Buddha, he says, I am no more a king. I am a Paccheka Buddha. So how the Paccheka Buddhas are dwelling and all these things he get to know. And he became Paccheka Buddha. And he went away from the kingdom. So the situation or the verse that is key to his attainment is mentioned this verse. Mitte suhacche anukampamano. Hapeti attang patibaddha chitto. So he was spending a lot of time without fully dedicating himself because of the friendship. So they were good friends, and these four ministers were good friends, and he trusted them. And because of them, and there are various other loved ones, so he didn't think of his own welfare. Rather, he sacrificed his own welfare and he spent more time in this kinship, taking care of the kingdom and taking care of all those responsibilities. So because the people who are close to him is very close by. I mean, they are quite close to his heart. So therefore, he couldn't immediately leave them aside. So he has a very intimate relation, kind of an intimacy with them. So that's why he couldn't leave them aside. But he understood that continuing like this, he is facing a lot of troubles. And even these people are sometimes not behaving the way he expects. And they are sometimes behaving in many different other ways that which he couldn't approve. So there he got some sort of a dispassion towards them. So there he understood the peril in that intimacy or such a kind of a close relationship. Seeing that, he was able to let go of that situation, and therefore he decided to be alone. He decided to live alone like a rhinoceros horn. So this is what mentioned in this sutta according to this particular verse. So there are various aspects that we can learn. There are four kinds of good friends typically mentioned in Dhamma. So one good friend is called Upakaramittu. So he actually is quite helpful. He is protecting yourself, and when you are sort of in a trouble, he is helping, and he is protecting your property and maybe your children. He is trying to protect, and he become kind of a refuge when you are in trouble. And if you are in need, if you ask something, he is giving from his own money or his own wealth. So likewise, he is quite a helpful friend. He is called Upakaraka Mitta. And there is another friend who is called Samana Sukadukka Mitta. So he actually shares everything with you. He reveals all his secrets with you, and he protects your secrets. He is not revealing those secrets to the others. And again, he shares his wealth with you. And if he is suffering, then he actually get help from you. And then he is not abandoning you when you are in the trouble. And again, even he is sacrificing himself, comfort on behalf of you. So he is called Samana Sukha Dukkha Mitta, who is sharing his happiness and suffering with you. And then another kind of friend, he is called Anukampaka Mitto. So he is a sympathetic friend. He is actually not rejoicing when you are in a trouble. So rather, he is trying to make yourself happy, and he is trying to get you good fortune. And again, if someone is talking ill of you, he don't recommend that. He basically avoids that, and he try to protect you and not approve that kind of ill-spoken discussion. So likewise, he is a kind of he is basically sympathizing you. So that is the other side. So that is another type of friend. Then there's another type called Attakkai. That is, he is actually always pointing out a good direction to you. So he's trying to restrain you. He's trying to show you kind of a more heightened path, a more developed path, rather than simply staying on the same level. And he's talking what is good and what is not good, what is correct and what is incorrect. So he is trying to show you a good path, a better path than in the present situation. So he is called Attakkai. So these are the types of good friends according to the Dhamma. And we also have gone through various such situations. All of you also have friends, and we can recognize who are the good friends. So these are in a way certain guidelines the Dhamma is given. So who is a good friend? A good friend is someone who is not sort of neglecting and even at your presence or absence, he is not talking ill of you. And if someone else is talking, he is trying to protect you, safeguard you. And so likewise, those are good features of a good friendship. Now, even such good friendship, or even if you have some other kind of an attraction towards another person, can lead to kind of an intimacy. So there you have a kind of a bondage. Now you have kind of an intimacy where you don't like to leave them. You want always to be with them. So you like their companionship. Assume that you want to go to another country. They say, don't leave me. Don't leave me. I will be alone if you are going. So that, like that. So this kind of an intimacy, sometimes going against our well-being. Say if you are trying to go further, so sometimes you might feel, so there is a kind of a huge bondage between your friends and yourself. And sometimes on the other hand, you might even also feel that without you, they can't survive. Without you, they will be in trouble. So I should not leave. So you may even have such kind of an attitude, because you may try to go to some other place or some better position, or you assume that you hope to complete dedicate yourself towards a spiritual life, but your friends don't approve it. So they want you to be with them, and they and you also feel that without you they can't survive, and you are the guidance for them, or you are the only say refuge for them. So likewise, you feel that they can't survive without you. So therefore, you let go of your future say progress, or let go of your future say attainments. Your well-being you are sacrificing because of your friends. So actually, this Paccheka Buddha in this particular verse, so that is the point he is highlighting, where he understood, so if I am continuously trying to satisfy these friends, or if I am continuously thinking that I am the king, I have to be like a mother, I have to be like a father, I always have to look after these my country people, my countrymen, and I should always take care of them. So likewise, more and more he thinks he can't go for a kind of a more higher spiritual life, because he has that kind of a bondage. So that is the hook he is being keeping. Now he understood that point. He understood that I have more capacity, I have more, say, potential. Rather than just being at this level, I have more potential going beyond this level. So having a close intimacy with certain people is becoming kind of a bondage for me. It's difficult to break that bondage. So he understands that point. So having understood that, now he started to live a life alone. So he started to be maintain a solitary life. So this is something in a way difficult to understand sometimes when we are leading lay life, because what we like is to have with our children, to have with our loved ones, to have with our friends. So this is the typical enjoyment we approve. And this is something that we like, being with our friends, being with our children, being with our husband, wife, whoever it is. Whoever we like to be with them. So that is how we gain happiness. But here, this story actually shows certain circumstances where one has to even let go of that. If he has more potential, if he has more potential towards a better life, or here we can say more in a spiritual life, so he is actually letting go of that, even such relationship, and he is going beyond. Probably, I mean, you might have heard various stories. Sometimes there are certain situations like, say, a son is trying to become a monk. So the father is trying to, say, avoid it. So he is telling, I mean, this much of wealth is available for you. And this is all my companies, all my responsibilities is for you. So this much I have collected, this much I have earned. So everything belongs to you. You are my only son. So what are you going to do? So likewise, there are many stories. Or else, a father is trying to go. So there are sometimes children, you might feel that they will suffer if you are going to leave. So this kind of situation is always there. So it's always, therefore, it's a kind of a comparison, kind of a difficult decision that one has to take. If you are going to sort of become a monk or become a nun, so this kind of situations is always there. So it is very difficult for one to take such a decision because of one's loved ones. Because sometimes of this kind of a, say, very close friendship. So the friends you can't leave aside. So therefore he is continuously being in the, say, in the lay life. Or even in the monk's life, sometimes suppose you are in a particular monastery, now you have recognized certain other monks or nuns who are more close to you, and assume that you have to go to another place. Now you are not leaving because you have a close relationship with that particular monk or nun. So these kind of relationships are common not only in the lay life, but even in the, say, in the monk's life. Because we, as human beings, we develop such relationships. So sometimes these relationships, if we are not in a way mindful, then it is going little far. Not maintaining to some manageable level, but it is going too far. Yeah, we feel that without him I can't survive, without her I can't survive. So that kind of a dependency is possible. So that is becoming kind of a danger in our lives. So then you are losing your independence. You are losing your kind of a ability to be kind of alone. So you always, you are dependent on the other party. All for everything you are going and asking, you are always sort of bugging him or her. So likewise, there are such situations. So those are the say disadvantages, dangers that mentioned in this sutta, in this particular verse. And in a way, there are certain things that we also can learn from this. And with that, I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I like to open the session for questions.
We have 9 questions today, quite a bit. Question number 1, walking mindfulness. Dear Venerable Bande, I enjoy practicing sitting and walking and managed to get my walking to a good regular daily practice. I've ridden several times on my practice and received excellent practical feedback from Bande. Much merits for your valuable service. My question today is about the thoughts and distractions of mind during the walking practice. The technique I use to bring the mind back is to check if I'm aware of the sensations of the sole of the foot. If I do it with a lot of vigilance and effort, I observe that the mind snaps back immediately and stays with the walking process. If I do it very gently, I observe that the mind comes back as drifting, very slowly comes back and settles, synchronizing with the walking process. Sometimes, seems like I can be mindful a bit while on the distracted state and also when it is coming back to the walking process. Is it beneficial to observe how the distracted mind comes back and the shifting of unmindful to mindful status and vice versa? Seems a bit adventurous and thought of checking with Bhante. With Metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, I think no harm. So even Lokusanase sometimes highlights this point. I mean, when you become unmindful, you can check how you are becoming mindful. So that turning point you can recognize. So that indicates a vigilance in your mind. Say you are unmindful, it is true. But later you become mindful and you recall and you recognize, okay, how again or how I was able to regain mindfulness. From which point I have regained mindfulness. So that is, in a way, we are somewhat say refining our mindfulness. So we are sharpening our mindfulness. So as we sharpen our mindfulness, those kind of very subtle details become evident, that you know when I have distracted. And during that distracted period, probably you have lost information. So you are in a different world. But later again, you were able to re-establish mindfulness. And you know from which point onwards I was mindful. So therefore, exploring this sort of information helps to further improve our mindfulness, to refine our mindfulness, and to have some sort of different, say, aspects of the mindfulness. So therefore, no harm in doing that. Yes.
Question number 2 of 9. General question, it's about the discussion today. Could Bhante please remind what the 4 stages of Bhana are and its significance? That's the end of the question.
Sorry, can you repeat again?
Could Bhante please remind us what the 4 stages of Bhana are and its significance?
Anatta? Anatta, is that the answer?
Jhana.
4 stages of jhana.
I think that means rupa jhana.
Yeah, I mean they actually categorize according to the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. So that is how they have named. The first jhana is mentioned that it has 5 jhana factors. vitakka vichara piti sukha ekagata. Vitakka is the applied mind, vichara is the sustained mind, piti is rapture, sukha is happiness, ekagata is the concentration. So the idea is, assume that you are taking a kind of an object, say anapana sati. So if it is the breathing has completely calmed down, and using which you are able to arouse kind of a sign, concentration sign, and now you are able to again and again apply your mind to that sign. So again and again applying your mind to that sign is the vitakka. And once you apply the mind, it is not getting distracted, rather it stays there and it is able to dwell in that sign. So that is the vichara. And as you are continuing this, now mind get used to it, and now even effortlessly you can be there. So now it is fairly attained. So your mind has attained to that particular concentrated state. So it is not even purposely have to take care of any distractions. Now mind does not get distracted. Mind has fairly absorbed to the whatever the sign. So, but it is absorbed and it is being there, it is dwelling there. And as a result of that, rapture arises, kind of a happiness is there. And comfort is there because you don't feel anything else, because the whole mind has almost like absorbed. Mind has become one with that object. So all the other sensations have gone. So therefore the happiness is there, pleasure is there. And again the ekagata, the concentration is there. In the second jhana, so the first two jhana factors are let go of. That is the applied thought and the sustained thought. So because one will understand that those are kind of disadvantages to have a very concentrated mind, well fixed mind. Because again and again mind has to apply and it is again and again moving inside that object. So one will understand the disadvantages of that, and he is going to fix one's attention. So first one's applying mind, and once it is applied and you are fixed there, not coming out, there is no movement. So therefore vitakka and vichara is discarded. Now simply being with the object, so more concentration, more fixation, and therefore rapture, happiness, and what is this, ekagata is there. And the third, you even let go of the rapture because it is little gross. So you let go of that, and therefore two jhana factors are there in the third jhana. So that is happiness, and that is more into the contentment, and the what you call the concentration. And once it comes to the fourth jhana, it is mentioned that you let go of even the happiness and you are going more mature equanimity than happiness. So equanimity, and then the concentration is there, collectedness is there. So that is the fourth jhana. Yeah.
Question number, I think it's 3 or 10. General question. Dear Pandey, thank you so much for this valuable session. This is something we look for towards every week, and sometimes the only time we get to stop everything and be with ourselves. I have heard multiple times you mention and briefly explained about thin slicing of time. I appreciate if you can give a bit more detailed explanation and how we can link it with the practice with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, say for example, suppose you do walking meditation and you are trying to focus your attention onto the touching sensation. So your foot is touching the ground and you are keeping your attention there. Now if you do it in a little lethargic manner, so you are not able to fully comprehend that sensation, so you may simply see that only hardness is there, that's all. But later assume that you are precisely keeping your attention there very quick, and very high resolution is also there. Now you probably can recognize, okay, during this particular period of time, not only hardness, there are many other qualities also available. It may be hardness is also there, and sometimes certain parts you can even feel softness, certain parts you can even feel certain heat or kind of dryness or wetness or even sort of a movement. So likewise, now you are able to recognize those details. So recognizing these details actually improves as we improve our mindfulness, and we are connecting what you call sampajanya, clear comprehension, into the picture. So as we are able to establish mindfulness, so we need to investigate the object. We need to investigate where we have established mindfulness. So that is the clear comprehension. So we are improving clear comprehension. So that is important. So that is where the thin slicing of time is important. So we have very limited time. So within that small time period, we are very quickly trying to recognize all that subtle detail. So for that, you need to quickly, you have to have thin slicing of time, otherwise you can't recognize all that information. So that is the point that we talked like that. We are using that thin slicing of time, but in other terms, we are developing sampajanya, clear comprehension. And in another way, we can call that we are improving or increasing resolution. In today's terms, suppose you have a camera. So if you have a camera with low resolution, so you get low information. But if your camera has high resolution, then it is more precise and you can get more information. Something like that.
Question number 4 of 10. General question. Dear Venerable Bhante, this is a Dhamma question. I have heard for something to happen, there are 5 laws. Those 5 being season or ritu, biology, beja, karma, dhamma and chitta. Would you please be able to explain dhamma niyama and chitta niyama, perhaps with some examples? Much thanks for your advice and guidance with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, so this actually, I also have tried to recognize these 5 niyama. So kamma, chitta, uttu, bija and chitta. So those are mentioned in Dhamma, but I couldn't find out where exactly it was mentioned. But anyway, chitta niyama is, in a way we can call that certain things, that when lust is there, parallelly you can't have hatred. When hatred is there, you can't have lust. And only in a way, one at a time. And sometimes we can call it's a kind of a series kind of situation. You can't have 2 things in parallel. And certain many things, I mean, say when you are developing wholesome aspects of the mind, so the unwholesome sides are fading away. So likewise, what we are learning pertaining to the mind, we can say it's all are common to every mind. It is not only to you. Even if someone else is developing that, so he also can enjoy those states because he also has a mind. It's a common phenomena. So it is a chitta niyama. It is not something unique to you, unique to me, unique to Buddha. So it is common. It is common to everyone who is developing wholesome aspects of the mind. So there's an inclination towards that. If one is developing unwholesome side, there's an inclination towards that. So the mind starts to incline towards that side. So likewise, there are many such qualities in the mind, so which is common to all the human beings, which is common to all the beings. So that is in a way chitta niyama. On the other hand, dhamma niyama, we can say, I mean, dhammata, there are certain, I mean, all the conditioned phenomena are impermanent. So that's a rule in a way. And all the conditioned phenomena can't provide lasting happiness. It's a dhammata. And there is no inner core. It is non-self. So it's dhammata. So likewise, so when we analyze those behaviors of all these phenomena, so there are such kind of English term, dhammata, those kind of certain rules, certain behaviors, certain logics we can recognize. So those we can say as dhamma niyama, where And there are various other definitions also may be available. So this I am talking through my memory. So I need to check, this in a kind of a vague way I can say like this.
Question number 5 of 10, general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, I have heard that if a person is in mindfulness practice, there will not be any karma committed by that person. Dear Bhante, would you please be able to elaborate and explain this point? Much merits for your great service with metta. That's the end of the question.
I can't say so, because if one is in mindfulness practice, so immediately if one says that you have completely eradicated karma and he is not accumulating any karma, so I think it is too early to say something like that. So even at the very higher, when one is at very higher vipassana level, only he may understand how to avoid making a self. So till that, he actually accumulate some amount of karma, because I making and mind making is something that people do. So we unknowingly we do that, habitually we do that. Even if you do mindfulness practice, sometimes unknowingly we might even compare with another person. So you are creating a self out of the practice. So that is also kind of an ignorance we have. So that can lead to have some subtle aspects of karma, but it doesn't go to very high level in the sense that you are not harming another person or something like that. So immediately, therefore, we can't say that one is able to completely eradicate karma just because of the mindfulness practice. But ultimately, it will happen. We can say so. If one is practicing satipatthana continuously for a long time and is able to fully comprehend one's mind and understand how eye making, mind making, all these things are happening, and he recognizes the non-self behavior, and all this kind of insights may help him to avoid any regeneration of karma. He is not making new karma in that sense. And again, when certain karma is ripening, so he is not reacting blindly to that, so that in that way he is not making a new karma. So likewise, therefore, we can generally say the vipassana practice is leading to such karma decaying kind of a process and not accumulating new karma. So I feel better to answer like that.
Question number 6 of 10 is a general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, could you please be able to explain the difference between jnana and prajna with metta? That's the end.
I feel these two are fairly similar, jnana and panya. So in Pali it is more into panya. So jnana is more into Sinhala. A Sinhala word is there jnana. I don't know, I need to check whether there are many situations which is mentioning about jnana in Pali. Mostly it is similar, interchangeably it is used, not big difference. Yeah.
Question number 7 of 10, general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, could you please explain the true meaning behind yoniso? Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, the typical, yoniso manasikara typically means that you are going to the source, you are going to the origin. Rather than staying at the surface level, you are going to the source, you are going to the origin. So the Pali term yoni is the vagina, so that is basically referring the birthplace. So that is, we are going to the root, we are going to the more to the source. So from that, actually that term has come. So the yoniso manasikara basically leads us to the source, not simply dwelling on the surface. Rather, it is going deeper and going penetrating deeper and going to the source. So that is the literal meaning.
Question number 8 of 10. a new question. Dear Bhante, during the Dhamma sermon and question and answer, we often hear about the understanding of sensory observations as continuous changing flux. Most of us who have developed a regular practice experience glimpses of this as well. After observing the nature of this ever-changing flux-like status, do we go beyond to understand what is beyond the flux or the real thing? My limited understanding is that rather than finding the real thing or the final status, we use this midway point to understand the role of the mind and focus towards grasping aversion and ignorance around the works of mind to liberate and free the mind. Is this a correct assumption, Bhante? The reason around this assumption is that if we keep on refining our understanding of the reality, we might end up in the final picture like Brahman or in Advaita Vedanta. Sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that. Tao in Taoism, or the opposite end of everything is fabricated without any form or of reality. Appreciate Bhante's views with metta. That's the end.
Yeah, it's a good question, some philosophical question in a way. So, I mean, if I refer you to the Buddha's teaching, so it's a kind of a gradual path where, our minds are fairly attached. We have a tendency to grasp because we feel that things are certain, things are permanent, things may give us happiness, and there is a person, there is a self in that experience. So therefore, the teaching and the practice is for more and more, vipassana, the looking at these experiences in a more different manner, so that one may have wisdom. So say for example, you develop some amount of concentration, and using that concentration, you focus to various phenomena and you start to observe them. So then you will understand the behavior of these phenomena, and that understanding will help us to arouse knowledge, wisdom. So if wisdom is there, Buddha mentioned that grasping is impossible. So because since we don't have wisdom, our mind starts to grasp. Now when there is wisdom, so that grasping, attachment, clinging, holding will be loosened in a way. So sometimes called as yathabhuta jnana dasana nibbidatthaya nibbiddam virajyati viraga vimuchyati. So likewise, kind of a causal development in many suttas Buddha have mentioned, where when you have good understanding, correct understanding, so that will lead to a dispassion rather than holding, rather than keeping attached, attracted. So you loosen that attachment. So instead of passionate, one becomes dispassionate. So that dispassion leads to letting go, and ultimately mind starts to become free. So when mind becomes free, so that is, we can say there is no anything to hold. So the mind does not establish at any place. So we can say vijnana does not establish at any place. So it is not established on any kind of a material form, does not establish on any kind of a feeling, not on any kind of a perception, any sign, and there is no any kind of a formations. In the sense that, any quality is also not coloring the mind. So mind has a kind of its own original kind of a nature. So in the Buddhist teaching, so this is not something attributed to a god. This state is not attributed to a god. So in the Hinduism, sometimes, so don't know whether it is the same thing that they are talking. So whatever the attainment. So they contribute, or they attribute it to a god, Brahma, where they say, okay, once you realize, you become that. So Buddha does not say like that. So Buddha say, if you become something, so there is becoming. So there is bhava, that you have become something. So you can understand bhava paccaya jati. So upadana paccaya bhava, bhava paccaya jati. Jati paccaya jana marana soka parideva. So all these suffering going to arise. So therefore Buddha never recommend to become something. So instead he is telling atammeta, one of the very interesting teaching of the Buddha, and very deep teaching of the Buddha, where he is not basically in another way we can say, rather than your mind becoming something, rather than you become someone, is it possible to have a mind which is free from any kind of attachment, any kind of becoming? So it has its own kind of a freedom. That is why it is called atammeta. So in simple terms, suppose say you develop anapanasati and you get kind of a concentration sign, and you can apply your mind again and again to that, and later you become that. So that is what we call jhana. That is what we call absorption. So mind has become that. But in vipassana, so Buddha doesn't say so. So Buddha doesn't ask us to become that or become this. So therefore, instead in the Buddhism, in the Buddha's teaching, so you become anisthita. You not grasping anything. So the mind is not that even. So mind is not rupa. Mind is not, say, sound. Mind is not sight. Mind is not, say, any kind of smell. So likewise, so the mind does not associate anything. So we can say so. So this non-associated state, are we going to attribute to a god? Are we calling it as Advaita? So these are things that we can actually explore. So later on in the Hinduism, actually I haven't studied Hinduism, therefore what I am telling you is also a kind of a very narrow knowledge I have related to the Hinduism. So later on, what they did seems that they are attributing certain parts from the Buddhism into their religion, to the Hinduism, and that is what Shankaracharya has done. So he has taken many parts from the Buddhism into the Hinduism, and he is coming up with this Advaita Vedanta. So the Advaita Vedanta was not with the Veda books in their original sense. So during the Buddha's time, there was no any Advaita Vedanta. So what they had was something very, some other teachings. But later on, once Buddha has passed away, so this Shankaracharya, Adishankar, so he is the teacher, so that he actually has acquired many teachings from the Buddhism into Hinduism, and he came up with a new Vedanta called Advaita Vedanta. So that has certain parts of the Buddha's teaching. But he is talking about a self. That's the difference. So he's talking about a self. So whenever, say, you are relinquishing this side and that side, so you have something middle, and you become that middle. So that is, we can say, so there is no two extremes, but you become something middle. So Buddha actually say, even to let go of the middle, you are not even attached to the middle. So therefore there are sort of significant differences. So therefore you can't say what you experience to Buddha's teaching is Advaita. So these are some complicated theories. So I am also not an expert in Advaita Vedanta, so I haven't done a very comprehensive comparison between Advaita Vedanta and the Buddha's teaching. So this is some knowledge that I have gathered from Bhante Dhammajiva, as well as by reading to some extent. There is a beautiful article from Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's talking about Buddha's teaching. He's comparing in a way Buddha's teaching as well as the Advaita Vedanta. And you can search in the internet. It may be available. So this is from limited knowledge. I can answer like this. Yeah.
Question number, I think it's 9 or 11. General question. Dear Venerable Bhante, with all respect, I would like to ask you, when you were a person before becoming a Venerable, what triggered you to ordain? How did you forget on that idea and become a Venerable? If any of us want to do the same, what should be the process? Is it necessary to take permission from guests? Dear Bhante, you can skip this question in case it is irrelevant.
So actually, I had an idea to become a monk from my childhood, but my parents didn't like that. And so my father and mother both didn't like it. So I have to continue studies and all these things. And later actually my father passed away, and then still I had an idea to continue in this spiritual side. Then actually I have to look after my mother. And once my mother passed away, only I was able to attain a monk. I mean to become a monk, because I had such responsibilities. So it is true that in the Buddha's say in the Sangha, so whenever you are coming to become a monk, so we ask whether you got the permission from your parents. So if you are going to go to the higher ordination, Mata Pituchi Anuktacham, so that is a kind of a question asked, whether your parents have approved it. So probably you can remember that when Buddha has mentioned that in order to get high ordination, that you need approval from your parents. So therefore, it has now become a rule and a custom that one has to have parents' approval if one has to become a monk. So you can try. Isn't it, Chatu?
we have two questions. Is it okay if we go a bit over time?
Fine, yeah.
Okay. Question 10 of 11, general question. Dear Bhante, please let us know what Alinkara Ahara, as it is explained in different ways. Put the Numantra Sutta, which we don't understand. Hopefully that makes sense.
No, I mean, Kabalinkara Ahara is the one, the gross food. So that is what we all eat. So those are fruits and vegetables and rice and curries and all these things are the Kabalinkara Ahara, where you divide into pieces, mix and all eat. So that is the Kabalinkara Ahara, the gross food. And there are three other types of Ahara, other types of nutriments explained in the Dhamma. Passa Ahara, the contact nutriment, and the Mano Sanchetana Ahara. That is that you are intentionally thinking and you do that kind of satisfaction. So that is called Mano Sanchetana Ahara. And then the Vijnana Ahara. So by seeing, hearing and all these ways of using the faculties. So you are constantly getting the information, getting the objects. And that kind of a constant transaction happen between our internal faculties and the external corresponding objects. So that is the Vijnana Ahara. And what's the other one? Putta Mansupama Sutra. So that is a sutta. Putta Mansupama Sutra is where Buddha talks about maintaining correct perspective about the food. So where not to in a way enjoy and have kind of a greediness towards the food, instead consider food as kind of a medicine. So the simile given is a very very powerful simile. So it's less time for us to go to that. That's Putta Mansupama Sutta is a very powerful sutta. So I think we'll take it to some other time.
Question number 11, this is the last one. Dear Bhante, in the Rhinoceros Sutta from today, we discussed non-attachment and walking the solitary path. How do you find a balance between providing sympathy and care to your loved ones and practicing non-attachment? For example, looking after elderly or sick family members. How can one serve their family and reduce clinging with metta? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, that is very true. That's a very practical question. So that is where we need to have self-compassion as well as compassion towards the others. So we have to have some sort of a balance. So finding this balance is always challenging. Now, even say if you are a monk, if you still have to have such kind of a balance. So to what extent you involved with various activities helping others, and to what extent that you are taking care of your own well-being. And being, say, you as a layperson, you still may have such kind of a situation. Say, how far that you are going to take care of others, and how far you are trying to look after yourself. So this is a kind of a constant struggle that we have to fight with. So to finding out this balance. So I feel that we always have to look after our loved ones or our elders and sick people and all these things. So it becomes part of our life, because we also ultimately become, say, helpless, and someone else has to look after ourselves. So likewise, this is a kind of the human nature we all have. And on the other hand, by helping a sick person, looking after and all these things, helps us to understand the reality of the life. So how vulnerable this life is, and how helpless we sometimes become, and so all these sides we can recognize, we can understand by recognizing someone else's suffering, by recognizing someone else's old age. And that actually helps to remove conceit in ourselves. And how to develop patience, because the other person is sometimes behaving inappropriate manner, which is detrimental to his health. So how I can avoid getting angry on such situations. So likewise, so if I am able to use that situation to see my mind, then there's an opportunity. But on the other hand, the other side is that if I am completely forgetting my own welfare and constantly going to accommodate my time only for the others, neglecting my own welfare, so then I am going to the other extreme, going to another extreme. So these two sides we have to balance. So I am also a person, he is also a person. Let me look after myself as well as himself. So I think that kind of approach is much better, because, and you as a person, you also have to safeguard yourself. So you can't always, say, be in a negativity, and if you are looking after another person, say someone else is dying. So again and again, when you are being with him, that what you get is some sort of a negativity. So it is not good for you. Because some kind of a balance of mental balance is essential. So therefore, time to time, be away from that person and to energize yourself. Again, regain your capacity. Again, regain your, say, enthusiasm is important. So I heard that even the psychiatrist, so they are also given some sort of a, say, vacation. They are not allowed to continuously treat patients for long time, because mostly they may be encountering the difficult situations of the others. So listening to them again and again for many years can make them depressed, can make them into kind of a mental breakage. So therefore they are given kind of a vacation or kind of a period for them to energize, for them to sort of have some positive sides of the life. So therefore I feel it is necessary to balance. So it's a challenging task actually. Yeah.
That was the last of the questions.
Yeah.
Because we've got over time, we'll end it there. First of all, I'd like to thank Bhante for giving up valuable time. We had a lot of questions today, I think 11, and also for actually giving up that time to do extra. I'd also like to pass on our merits to Bhante and also to the organizers, people seen and unseen, who are participating in this program. And also, lastly, to the participants, because without you, there would be no program. So with that, I'd like to end the program. Theruvan Sarnai.
Yeah, Theruvan Sarnai. Theruvan Sarnai.